part of it. But still, at that point, when I was writing it and trying to explain it, I realized that who am I to explain why Prabhupada installed Radha Krishna deities, or to leave it at that, that this is why he did it. So then I wrote, but the infinite purity of his heart and the depth of his determination to risk anything for their lordships, Sri Sri Radha and Krishna, are unfathomable. Prabhupada's activities are most grave, and their deeper meaning eludes an observer. Of Lord Chaitanya, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami wrote, I do not know the deep meaning of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's activities. I am just trying to describe them externally. So from witnesses, we know what Prabhupada did, and they're instructive and so on, but we never say that we know the real depth of everything. Like that's still that nice story that Kalyapani told on the first days, that the devotee was saying, Tamal Krishna Maharaj was saying, that Prabhupada met his spiritual master only very few times in his life. So that was a fact. But when Prabhupada heard that said about him, he smiled broadly and explained later that actually he was always with his spiritual master. So similarly, many of the things we say, if Prabhupada is hearing them, he's amused at our attempt to explain his life. And I hope he's not displeased if we make a sincere attempt. When Prabhupada left, he did install the deities. He made a prayer to Radha Gopinath. What was that prayer? Must be some Australian devotees here. What was it? Louder? My dear Lord, I leave you in the hands of the mlechas. I can't be responsible. You please take care of yourself. How do we know that Prabhupada made such a private prayer? Yes?
Because the next year he actually told us in Australia he made a new promise. Uh-huh. One night he asked, when he saw a particularly nice outfit, he asked, who has made this outfit? And it was very nice when he found that. And another night he asked, who has made these crowns? Because they have beautiful crowns on. He said, very good. And then he told us that he made this gift. And Krishna has, from within his pure hearts, he has gone to it.
So it's not that they have to stay perpetually as mleches. I wrote about that as a short stanza. But Prabhupada knew it would not be long before the land of the mleches would be transformed and their deity as royally worshipped and enthroned as the finest mandirs of the East, and with even more devotion. Does anyone know some other examples of Prabhupada making private prayers to deities in ISKCON temples? Yes?
He was asking Prabhupadish why is he in back to India?
Good. In 1969, when Prabhupada left America, he said he thought that he was going to stay in America and preach there, but the events had led to him going back to India. So as he left, he prayed, I don't understand. My intention was to come and live here and serve here. Why are you sending me back to India? Yes? I will build you a beautiful temple. Please go to this inadequate situation now. Any more? Can you think of one? You who are from England? Yes.
What's the Srila Prabhupada's
Buddha's last visit to England, he prayed to the deities there to please engage him in Shivarasa.
Yes, he prayed to Radha Nandanishwar, please engage me in the service of Radha Rasa Vihara. So, the next visit that we're going to discuss is Prabhupada going to Moscow. So, this was 1971. And it was very daring at that time because of the atheistic policy and the repression of the Marxist government. His visit was the beginning of the spread of Krishna consciousness, which continued covertly for over 15 years before the Glasnost era began, and it was no longer a criminal act to live as a Hare Krishna devotee. But when we think about Prabhupada's visit in 1971, we should keep in mind all these extraordinary events. And what seemed impossible then has now happened. Russia is the leading country for making devotees and selling books. And the USSR doesn't even exist as it did then. We could speculate on the role Prabhupada played in the demise of Marxism. But more important is, for us, just to take his visit within its own context in 1971 and try to see what Prabhupada's attitude was. And this much we can conclude safely, that his visit anywhere is never accidental or without tremendous potential for spreading Krishna consciousness in an immediate sense and as a consequence that happens later in a chain of cause and effect, just because he desires to spread Krishna consciousness in any place. Prabhupada called his tactic in like a needle and out like a plow. So, what was the external event that led to him going to Russia, or we could say his supposed reason for his visit, as known by the authorities there? Vegati.
He had been corresponding with Professor Kapowski, who said that if he came, he would arrange some lecture.
Right. This came up through devotees in Germany. Now, in the correspondence, also Prabhupada was tactical, and he was speaking about Krishna culture that he wanted to teach. He didn't say, I wanted to come and teach about God, which he did in England when he went there. I've come to teach what you have forgotten, God. But he said, I want to teach Krishna culture, which should be acceptable to any reasonable person. So this is a good key to how to preach when religion is very much unappreciated in some country. A preacher adapts himself. The talk, of course, has been printed, but I've just outlined some of the points to give it some attention. Of course, there was a difference between Prabhupada, the relationship between Prabhupada and Katovsky in correspondence, and when they actually met. What was the difference? Yes? Yeah, now that the Swami came into his office, the man was much more reserved and cautious. It was one thing to exchange some interesting academic letters. Oh, plus, maybe to some degree he could understand what Prabhupada was. And he said any other lectures would be impossible. They would just have one talk. So it was quite a different mood. Prabhupada explained Varnashram to him, and Katovsky said, it's interesting, but the difference with socialism is that there are no vices in our scheme. Prabhupada said, yes, that's true. Kalo sudra sambhava. But if it's true that there are only sudras and no Brahmins or scientific division, then there'll be chaos. And Prabhupada said, the Vedic science teaches four orders, just as in the human body, head, arms, belly, and legs. Modern society doesn't know the purpose of human life. They do not know what is the next life. And then Katovsky said, Swamiji, when the body dies, the owner also dies. And Prabhupada would repeat this many, many times later. It was a real specimen of ignorance, even by the big professor. Prabhupada said that this Krishna consciousness and Varnashram should be studied scientifically by a department in the universe. It should be studied whether there is a soul. Prabhupada said, we accept authority, that's how we get our knowledge. And the professor countered, we don't, we accept empirical evidence. That's the way to know something. But then Prabhupada got him to agree that on the principle of surrender, that we have to surrender to someone. Katovsky said, yes, we surrender to the whole people. Then the professor said, we believe in surrender, but also in revolution. It doesn't stop. You surrender, but then eventually there may be another revolution. And then Prabhupada said, yes, until you come to Krishna. He gave the example that a baby will cry until it's, and then it's put in the arms of the mother. And then he asked the professor, and then what happens when it's put in the arms of the professor? And he said, yes, the baby is satisfied. So Prabhupada did very well in talking with him. But then after it was over, it was like that was the reason he came, and there was nothing else planned and nothing else he could do because the government was controlling his activities as on a special tourist plan. He could either go on the tours or do nothing, more or less. But something else did happen. What else happened in Moscow in the few remaining days that Prabhupada had? Yes?
Prabhupada's servant went out to buy some vegetables and he met one Indian person who greeted him and he was his friend.
Uh-huh.
And he went back to Prabhupada's apartment.
Right. Shamsundar again. He met an Indian diplomat's son and a Russian citizen, and talked to them. They were interested. He was wearing a dhoti, and they were starved, especially the Russian was, to hear things about the West. So he brought them back to see Prabhupada. And that person later became initiated. Now we're talking about after Prabhupada left. He became initiated and he was the first preacher in Russia. So Prabhupada gave him some basic instructions in Krishna consciousness. What were some of the things that he taught him as essential within a few days to make this person ready to preach Krishna consciousness? Yes?
To offer food.
Chant. Hare Krishna. Cooking and chant, such practical things. Yes.
He also taught the difference between the soul and the spirit in the relation to Krishna.
And very good. How did he prepare him to preach in this country where preaching was illegal? Yes. Yeah, as Prabhupada himself was doing. Very quiet kirtan and a discreet meeting in private home. He told him to do that. If you don't have, you cannot do otherwise, then do that. So this was very wonderful preaching by Prabhupada. We sometimes talk of our travels and our preaching, especially the sannyasis and other devotees. Where are you traveling? Where are you preaching? Oh, I went here. I did this. This many people chanted with me. I gave a class here and there. But the ideal motive and attitude for preaching is Prabhupada's, and we should try to follow that. It may be that sometimes we want to be famous as a preacher, or we have some other motive, just doing our duty maybe. But Prabhupada had this intense desire. He was going to Russia unnoticed, but with faith that he could spread Krishna consciousness by going there, not to get some fame. He just wanted to please Krishna. Like Bhakti Sananda Saraswati Thakur said, go, please Krishna, and even if no one is there but the four walls, it will be heard by Krishna and appreciated. Prabhupada flew directly from Moscow to Paris. Now we see an example of some really extensive jet age traveling at an exhausting pace. He went to Paris and immediately, first of all, he had trouble for hours before he could get through the immigration. Then he went straight to a preaching engagement, not even to rest, at the Indian tourist office, met reporters, then went to the temple. And he was going, it was mostly just a quick stop, then to go on for another huge jump. If you're going to America from Paris, at least you go to New York to break your journey. But he went to Los Angeles from Paris. But so in this brief visit in Paris, we can note something, quite a contrast from the beginning days of his preaching. Because his time was limited, the movement was expanding very widely, so he didn't have time to personally train devotees in a personal way. This was his first visit to Paris, yet he kept it very brief. Therefore, the preaching now was, although he was personally coming, it was also being done through his representatives, senior devotees, and through his books. And he expected a higher standard than before. So even though this visit was so brief to Paris and in similar visits, the devotees were not dissatisfied with Prabhupada or think, well, we don't have a relationship with him. So in spite of such limited association, in some cases, no personal association, the devotees were able to dedicate their lives to serving him. So what does this say about Prabhupada, that he was able to make such a brief visit and still they were appreciative? Someone can say something. Yes?
Even in the presence of pure devotee, it's purifying
the devotee. Yeah, yes. This shows Prabhupada's stature as a pure devotee, as a topmost devotee, that people are grateful just to take the dust of his feet or where he walked, that he came to our city, not thinking, why didn't he stay longer? We paid for his ticket. He should do this program and do that program. But he's worldwide Paribhajakacharya, and if he stops in your city, you feel very blessed. Yeah.
My experience with Prabhupada is that his potency was such that he could just glance at you, and you would remember that glance, you know, change the rest of your life.
Good. Yeah, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Yes?
Krishna made the point that just like when Krishna moved into the arena, everybody was satisfied in the different relationships with him. And in the same way, Prabhupada was in the whole room of devotees, and they were all feel satisfied with some personal
life. Good. Yes?
Well, the first that states that Mother Madras service that he called by just a moment's association.
Just an 11th of a second. Then, so Prabhupada went to Los Angeles. It had been 6 years now since his first visit to America, and quite a while since he had been in America. And this period was a period of huge growth. There were literally hundreds of devotees waiting to get initiated from the last time Prabhupada had been in America, all over the country, just waiting for him to go, not to their city, but near their area of the country. And they would go there. There were mass initiations held. And the devotees, they ecstatically thronged to the meeting places where he went to. So there's such a combination of him widely traveling and the devotees responding so enthusiastically. From Los Angeles, he went to Detroit for the first time ever. And I noted, we had a number of witnesses who greeted him at the airport, and many of them said about, people were crying, many devotees were weeping when they saw Prabhupada. It was a very emotional arrival in that airport. And he stayed there for a few days. A couple of incidents that happened there are referred to. One was after a lecture, devotee Baholasva raised his hand. Srila Prabhupada, what is the thing that will please you the most? Chant Hare Krishna, Prabhupada replied, and the devotees cried out, Jai, Jai. Then there's another thing that happened, which Professor Larry Shin noted. He thought this was a very important exchange, that as Prabhupada was leaving the temple that evening, the mother of one of his disciples approached him. You know, she said, these boys actually worship you. Yes, Prabhupada said, that is our system. I am also worshipping my Guru Maharaj. The devotees around Prabhupada looked at one another and smiled. Although the woman had tried to make it appear extraordinary that Prabhupada's disciples worshipped him, Prabhupada had taken it casually. One must worship the Guru. It was the Vaishnava standard and nothing to wonder at. Some points about this travel, preaching, and the devotees' response. One is that it wasn't sense gratification for Prabhupada that he wanted followers and so on, and that his ISKCON was growing. But he was the same pure servant of the Lord and the Guru. Now, about so many initiations, and we people who had only been devotees for a few weeks in some cases, this means that he initiated too many disciples and unqualified disciples sometimes. So he was aware of that, but he was aware of the great need and was willing to do whatever was necessary, just like the gopis were willing to take the dust from Krishna's feet to relieve him of a headache, even if it meant they would go to hell for being so presumptuous to take the dust of God's feet. He was ready to do whatever was necessary. And he has written in the Nectar of Devotion that without increasing the number of disciples, there is no propagation of the cult of Krishna consciousness. Therefore, sometimes at a risk, a sannyasi in the line of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepts a person who is not thoroughly fit to become a disciple. Later, he is gradually elevated. But if you do it for honor, the guru will surely fall down. So, does this principle still hold true now in ISKCON for persons who are initiating that there should be wide acceptance of devotees more and more? Anyone like to comment on that? Yes?
So I think in ISKCON now we have many different gurus that can take charge of many group of disciples. So it would be, it shouldn't be a burden for only one guru to have a mass of disciples.
Good point. And principle is still true. Prabhupada wrote it in Nectar of Devotion, and he said it was the opinion of Jiva Goswami that the followers of Lord Chaitanya, they take that, they don't stop, they continue to accept disciples, but they shouldn't take, Prabhupada said, they shouldn't take cheap disciples, and they can't imitate Prabhupada with unqualified disciples. Therefore, we also have a standard. We don't initiate somebody after a week or anything like that. Standard 16 rounds and 4 rules for a year. Another notable thing is, which was already has been mentioned, that devotees felt their connection with Prabhupada even though they mostly saw him from afar. After Detroit, Prabhupada visited Boston and installed the deities Radha Gopi Balabha. I have a few stanzas about that. When I paid in advance for the top floor suite, she gave me a long-stemmed rose and asked, "Why do you spend so much for your guru?" "It is our small expression of love," I explained. "He is a pure devotee of God, and all should treat him with honor." But Prabhupada would not accept it. "The hotel is like a brothel," he said, "and the temple is Vaikuntha." Another visit to Boston was not important compared to his worldwide preaching, but we had been begging him for a year to please bring Radha and Krishna and initiate some followers. But he was disappointed to find a broken window pane and on the front lawn yellow grass. I had excuses why the overflowing paint can he saw from his room was not a waste, but was due to the rain. Never mind, he said, we obtain everything at great labor, so do not waste Krishna's energy. And there's more. So many stories, so many impressions in the heart, and so many people, so many visits. Then Prabhupada went to New York, July 1971. There were so many devotees to be initiated. The initiations were held 5 consecutive days with about 25 people each day. This is in Henry Street in Brooklyn. Prabhupada lectured, and not only in Brooklyn but in other times, he would often give as a solution the joining of ISKCON and coming to live in the temple. I want to read a poem about that and then ask you to make an applied question. The poem is called Come Live With Us. These are Prabhupada's words. Someone asked, I think it's all in the poem. A small room jam-packed with 200 people and more standing at the door, in the hallway and on every stair. But everyone was quiet as he spoke. Even the neighbors were miraculously subdued. Prabhupada was in triumph, speaking Bhagavatam, his lectures on Ajamil and sinful reaction, delivered gravely to responsive ears. No longer alone without temple or home, but in 60 worldwide centers with brilliant hopes for all. The sparkling chandeliers, the velvet curtains were not for him. It was the temple of Radha Govinda and the residence of their servants. The vision was taking shape and Prabhupada was happy. Speaking for himself, a man inquired, how can a sinner get rid of his karma? Come live with us, said Prabhupada. You simply come and live with us. The first boys in New York had heard that hint, come live with us, and had promptly moved in with Prabhupada. He meant, you either live in the temple or at least always visit. Be packed up tightly in the association of devotees, or else your home is like a cage of fire. When he heard in Los Angeles that the neighbors were envious, just look, new cars and bright faces, he had replied, then tell them to come and live with us, but that they won't do. Come live with us meant come to ISKCON. That was why he had formed it, to bring the members of the society together with each other and nearer to Krishna. If a person did not live with devotees, how could he expect to rise early for japa of the holy name, or how could he expect to avoid illicit sex? If in a person's house there was no rhythmic kirtan, then how could one live there? And so he invited, come live with us. And he was building more places, temples for his Lord and residences for his devotees. That was his desire, to bring the members closer together for the purpose of teaching a simple, more natural way of life. On another topic, we asked the question, the way ISKCON was confident in its growth and the preachers went out pioneering, is this mood still there? And Jai Dwaj Maharaj answered, it depends on where you go in the world. Some places it is, some it isn't. This is a slightly different question about the come live with us principle. Is this still true? Has it changed? You want to say? Yes. Want to do that again?
Sure, that's where you go.
Okay, so a one-liner. Anyone want to add to that? Yes?
Before I read that in the Bhagavad Gita, and I hadn't read it as much, but I always remember that it always kept popping up in my head that, and that was kind of helped me go to the temple.
Prabhupada saying, come live with us?
Yeah, I read it in the Bhagavad Gita too.
His lecture?
Yeah, it was a question.
Huh. I think that very question and answer. There's one change that didn't exist then, was more the possibility that you didn't have to literally live in the temple building. You used to think that it was Maya if you lived outside. But Prabhupada has written in his purports, we don't expect everyone to live in the temples. Rather, we expect so many people to come that we couldn't possibly fit them in communal living in the temples. So people will live in their homes, but they should make their homes like temples. But that would still be within the principle of come live with us. That would be a positive change that has occurred over the years. But there have been also changes that are not so positive. Just have to move along. I don't have any comments about, because of time, his visit to Gainesville, Florida, and the stopover on the way there at Atlanta, Georgia. There's some nice memoirs. After that, though, he went again to England. And I wanted to end with some talks he had with his secretary when he was in England. This is in the unabridged. Prabhupada speaking strongly with dissatisfaction that the GBC and the BBT weren't producing his books. I've marked a few of the statements. He said, "Why are there no books? We have a book. Why do we have a book trust? What have they done? There is no stock of big books. There are no literatures in foreign languages after 5 years of promises and plans. Why hasn't the unabridged Bhagavad Gita, as it is, been printed yet? This sleeping, this leisurely work will not do. They can learn activity from an old man like me, because my determination is like this. If I die working, it is a great credit. This slow process of printing is the most condemned position." And what did, in case you've read this, what did Prabhupada then threaten to do about this? Yes. Yes, wasn't that he was threatening as much as telling them what would happen. He says, "Why should I go on translating when you cannot print? You say, retire and translate, but why should I translate? No one will ever see it. This restlessness, this diversion has to stop. Why don't you print? Always you say, it is to be done, it is to be done, that's all. And big men complaining, either he goes or I go. When the father is providing, it is the duty of the son to serve. I am the father. I am giving you everything. Why don't you serve me by printing these books? If only one book is read and understood, that is sufficient to make him Krishna conscious. Don't you see how important it is?" This is Prabhupada as a thunderbolt. Now we can take this as history that, well, now the pressure is off, all the books have been printed, so there's no question of Prabhupada being dissatisfied like that. But how may this be applied or updated in terms of Prabhupada's desires and possible dissatisfaction? Yes?
Reading of the same books in different languages.
Yeah. Well, you better get to work in Spain. You can just hear Prabhupada saying, after all these years, how many books do you have? So the books have not been even printed in many languages. And then distributed. What were you going to say? Anything? Now the distribution must continue of the books. So Prabhupada has different moods, and they're all relishable to us for different reasons. I think I'll, rather than go to the last minute, I'll stop. I request you to give me notes that I can comment on in the beginning of the class. And tomorrow we'll Let There Be a Temple Part 1, and we have a special guest, Giriraj Maharaj, is coming. I asked him to take over and speak as much as he wanted, but he said he will be in the audience and make contributions as it occurs to him. So we look forward to that. All right, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. So we have a title, Let There Be a Temple, for two lectures, today and tomorrow. Today is part one, Unbreakable Determination. Let There Be a Temple is Prabhupada's expression, describing his desires, which were fulfilled by Krishna, and they were carried out by Prabhupada's devotees and Prabhupada himself. So this is the story of the construction of the three major temples in India, in Mayapur, Vrindavan, and Bombay. And today, we're going to discuss Bombay, and we're fortunate that His Holiness Giriraj Swami is here. Actually, whatever we've compiled in the Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita is mostly from interviews with Giriraj Maharaj. So this will be very nice that he can partake today. Because I was actually afraid of this lecture, that it would come off just a rather dry and presentation of so many facts that I wouldn't be able to give life to. So this is a relief for me. First of all, establishing that this is worth studying with a nice anecdote. In June 1977, when Prabhupada was here in Vrindavan, he was sitting in the garden with Tamal Krishna Maharaj and other devotees, and they were reviewing Prabhupada's activities in different places over the years. Prabhupada was saying that he had gone to America and the preaching there had given him great hope, and he had actually intended to stay in America. So Tamal Krishna Maharaj then asked, "Do you regret having come back to India?" Prabhupada said, "No, my plan was to stay in America, but Krishna's plan was different. Therefore, when I was coming back, I was speaking to Dwarkadish," that's the Krishna deity in Los Angeles, "saying, 'I came here to preach. I don't know why you are dragging me back.' So I was unhappy to leave, but Krishna had his plan." Then Prabhupada briefly described the plan, to leave Vrindavan, to go to America and begin the Krishna consciousness movement, and then to go back to India. This was Krishna's plan. And the result of that plan, Prabhupada said, was that now we have this wonderful Krishna Balaram temple here in Vrindavan, where he was sitting and talking in 1977. So then Tamal Krishna Maharaj said, "You always come out victorious. In Bombay, it seemed to be an impossible situation." Prabhupada, "Yes, no one was interested. Who could see that such a big project would come up?" Tamal Krishna Maharaj, "They should write a book about that." Prabhupada, "It is history that is worth writing about. Mayapur also." This was an inspiration for working out all the details of the story and telling it in Prabhupada Lilamrita. Prabhupada saying that it's worth writing about this history. And we should be confident that Prabhupada's life is worthy subject matter for spiritual discussion, whatever he does. Yesterday at the end of the class, we were kind of rushing as usual, and I had some material to sum up the discussion about Jetage Paribhajakacharya, but I let it go. And I was thinking later that actually that in interpreting, analyzing, explaining, they're inevitable, that we want to do that, but it seemed secondary just to talking more and more about Prabhupada and hearing about him. So it needs no further excuse for telling. It is serious and it is delightful and it increases our attachment to him. So externally, this is a story of temple construction. So it makes us think about what is a temple, the importance of a temple. So I wanted to, before we get concentrate on Bombay, think about the importance of a temple and ask you, according to Prabhupada's teachings and example, what is a temple? And give some definitions. Yes, Jason? Yeah, a place where people can come and hear. Prabhupada used to say, no one listens to a poor man. If I advertise that I'm sitting in a field, you can come and hear Bhaktivedanta Swami, people won't come. A place where they can come for festivals and prasadam and so on, for the public to gather, that aspect of it. Then another aspect. Yes?
Say the temple is Vaikuntha.
Vaikuntha. So, right? So we may live in contrast to the forest, which is the mode of goodness, the brothel, mode of ignorance, and so on. As we were discussing yesterday, someone said, how can a sinful person get rid of karma? Prabhupada's reply was, come live with us. So not only the public can visit, but the devotees can live there. Someone laughed when he said Vaikuntha. You're thinking, well, I know it's not Vaikuntha. But it's a sample of the spiritual world. It's a Vaikuntha that we can improve on by acting like Vaikuntha people. And anyway, that's to live together in Krishna consciousness in the temple. So those are very important aspects. Now, what's another one?
Yeah. You also say that an
embassy of the spiritual world. Yes, and that reminds me of it's an institution where the science of the soul and the science of God is taught. Prabhupada would challenge, where in the world, there's so many universities, is the science of the soul being taught? So it's an educational place, just like now, VIHE. Now, it's a very important aspect still. Yes,
it's also a place, Prabhupada said, temples are like outposts from which soldiers go out to fight lions.
Yeah, a base. I mean, go out from the base, like in a war, to drop bombs, the books, like drop them like anything on the populace. Yeah?
Whenever the Lord is the center.
Ah. Very good. The Lord lives there and the devotees serve him in his Archavigraha form. So, now let's look at Prabhupada, where he is now in this life that, as we're studying. The Hare Krishna movement has begun with struggle alone in New York. Now it's expanded all over the world. And he's gone back to India. First, we're hearing how he traveled with a small band around India giving programs. But now he wants to establish it more. Prabhupada couldn't establish Krishna consciousness in India in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. But now coming back, he's trying to do it. So, here's another question for the class to try to understand Prabhupada's role in this Let There Be a Temple. Why was Prabhupada's personal management or presence needed for the temple to become about in India? Yes? Devotees would easily get cheated, so he would do it personally. Whereas in America, he thought, it's your money and you can spend it the way you want. I'll give you advice, but Prabhupada didn't deal so much with American businessmen, although he did and he could. But in India, he thought the devotees were like innocents and they again could very much get cheated unless he managed. What else? Another reason. I have a reason here that his plans were so big in scope that his disciples couldn't understand them. So he had to be there and do it. Professor Bayard has written an introduction to this book, or no, forward, after reading it. And he made a couple of comments. One was that there's an inner meaning to this story. And he asks the reader to appreciate this, and he says it is given in the book. There's an outer story, and there's an inner story. So we also want to try to recall that or realize the inner meaning as well as the outer. Another point he makes, he says he appreciates that the biography treatment tells all the facts without, even though some of them might be construed as detrimental to the portrait that we wish to make of His Divine Grace, but they're told, and because of the inner meaning, and it comes out to be not detrimental. So, now, in Prabhupada Lilamrita, we weaved the three temples' constructions into a story, trying to follow the way it happened. A little bit of Mayapur development, a little bit of Bombay, a little bit of Vrindavan. We want to concentrate on Bombay today because it's very difficult to tell the whole story in our limited time, and because Giriraj Maharaj is here, and especially it's such a terrific story, it's such a compelling story, it deserves a special treatment. So, Mayapur and Vrindavan are holy dhams. It would seem natural to build a temple there. Why build a temple in such a materialistic place as Bombay? And the reason is, Bhakti Saranda Saraswati Thakur thought big cities were the ideal places to chant, to preach, because so many people are there. And Bombay is like the number one city, a gateway to India. And there are many devotees there, and they also have money, and so on. So for a preacher, it's equally obvious as an ideal place to do something wonderful. The devotees were already situated in downtown Bombay. What is the address called?
The Kashganga
building. And then Prabhupada found a place where he wanted to build a temple. He had seen this place as early as 1965 when he was living at the Scindia colony, ready to go on their steamship to America. Now he saw it again. And it was just like a jungle, undeveloped piece of land at that time. So when he spoke to the devotees that he wanted them to get this place, they were not so enthusiastic about it. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj said to Prabhupada, that he was the GBC at that time of India, that to move into this undeveloped place would be very austere and difficult for us. We are Westerners, we're used to living in a civilized place where there are doorknobs on the door and running water. So what was Prabhupada's reply to that? Yes, General.
Don't you want to get purified?
Yes, don't you want to be purified? So now we can begin asking Giriraj Maharaj some questions. What did you and the other devotees think when Srila Prabhupada made that statement?
I had mixed feelings. I knew that we would have to face hardships, and I wondered whether we would be able to tolerate and adjust. But at the same time, I also knew that Srila Prabhupada wanted it, and that the whole purpose of spiritual life was to satisfy the spiritual master. So we resolved ourselves that this was what we had to do.
Could you describe a little what it was like, what the condition of the land was like,
so we can appreciate what he meant?
On the back portion of the land, there were some apartment buildings with tenants, but the front portion was vacant. It was overgrown with bushes and weeds. So we had to clear the front portion and then erected some tents for the devotees to stay in. and the tents, I think were not even real tents as we know in the West, but they were more like just bamboo poles stuck in the ground with some cloth around them. And then for bathing, there were some outdoor taps, and Srila Prabhupada had us put up some chetai sheets. They're like, what? Chetai is dried palm leaves. Yeah, thatch, you could say. And so we would fill up the bucket from the tap and then go in the enclosure and pour the water over ourselves. But one of the most surprising things is there were two public toilets in the back, which some of the tenants used. And Srila Prabhupada didn't want us to use the same facilities as them. So for us, he had us just dig some holes in the ground, and the same thing, put some bamboo poles and attach some cloth around it. He didn't want us to mix too much with the tenants.
I heard about rats and snakes.
That came a little later. initially, Srila Prabhupada arranged a pandal program on the land. And then he left Bombay. And after he left Bombay, we built like a... It was quite big, but again, it was just made of thatch. And there was a concrete floor, but the concrete wasn't made properly. It was crumbling under our feet. And that's where many rats came to stay.
So we may not mention every step exactly. If there's any steps you want to talk about that I don't mention, you please feel free. But Prabhupada used to have groundbreaking ceremonies even before so much was really there, just to declare the action and establish things. So there was a groundbreaking ceremony, and as we'll hear later in the history, it was in a second groundbreaking ceremony to indicate that this first one was just really like when there's a... Sometimes when they're in war, they put their flag down even before they really won the territory. So it was like that, a groundbreaking. And then the really startling thing that we read about in this history is that in such primitive conditions, maybe young devotees could put up with it to some extent, but Prabhupada moved the deities, Radharasa Vihari, to this land. And we discussed yesterday the prayer that he made to them. Who remembers the prayer that he prayed to them? Yes? So, Giriraj Maharaj, could you explain your understanding of, on one sense, it's kind of clear what he's saying, but how Prabhupada dared to do that, and as far as you can understand, what he's thinking of asking Krishna to do this, and maybe a little bit about the conditions of the deity worship.
Well, initially the deities were installed in the pandal, and after Srila Prabhupada left, we made a very makeshift deity room and temple, again just bamboo poles and simple cloth and a little platform with wood planks. But as the rainy season was approaching, we realized we couldn't keep the deities there. And In the meantime, we were building the ashram, which had a rough cement floor and chetai walls and a tarpaulin roof. So we set aside one hall. I mean, the rooms were divided again by chetai sheets. And we set aside one room for the deity. And for the whole rainy season, they stayed in the same hut with us. And as far as Srila Prabhupada's inviting them,
let me put it in the form of like a doubtful question. Isn't this offensive to bring deity Radha Krishna into such a situation?
Well, Srila Prabhupada knew the inner desires of the deities, which is to preach. And he saw the land as some important place from which he could preach. And he also had some suspicion about the deal. And later he commented that because he had some doubt about the transaction, he brought the deities there to establish possession on the property.
He said, once the deities are installed on a piece of property, no one will remove them.
Yes.
But another doubt, couldn't somebody say, but that's like using Krishna you're supposed to serve Krishna, you're using him to fight on your behalf when it's really not nice for him yet.
I can only say that that the relationship between Srila Prabhupada and the deities was very intimate, and they could reciprocate on a level which is beyond us. And certainly from our position, we wouldn't dare to do such a thing. But from his position, he could.
I think of Sanatana Goswami and the Krishna deity, that the deity even complained. You're not giving me good enough, but he said you have to. So you can almost think of Prabhupada like that.
I thought of the same example.
Right.
So the according to the history, Prabhupada of course had to continue his worldwide preaching. He couldn't stay in Bombay, although in a sense it demanded his full attention. So he had to put a person in charge. And first Madhuvisa Swami was put in charge, and then he told Prabhupada he couldn't do this, he didn't want to do it. He wanted a break from India, he wanted to go to Australia. And then after that, Prabhupada went to Africa to get Brahmananda Swami to bring him to be in charge. And that didn't work out either. He was called back to Africa because of the needs there. So Giriraj was a brahmachari then, who was outstanding for collecting for life membership. I think Prabhupada said manager, he's the best collector, so manager means the one who's collecting the money, he's the leader. Something like that, or you can correct me. So anyway, what point I'm getting to is, Prabhupada, I want to ask Giriraj Maharaj how he felt when Prabhupada left him there alone. Not alone, but how he felt alone in the sense that Prabhupada went away. And so he was alone. And in terms of how you had to serve now in separation, and how in separation from Prabhupada, how did you, can you tell us about that?
Well, after we left Srila Prabhupada at the airport. We came back, and then I sat down in front of the deities, and I thought, what am I going to do now? And I didn't know what to do. But Srila Prabhupada had given some instructions before he left. One instruction was that the senior devotees should meet together and discuss everything together. So we did that. But we found two problems there. One was that often we had different opinions, and at least I didn't know how to reconcile them. And the other thing is that often we were discussing subjects that none of us really knew, and that was another problem. Srila Prabhupada had also suggested some friends of his, some life members that we could consult. And we also consulted them and asked them to help, and they were also willing to help. But we didn't know very well how to engage them or deal with them. So it was quite difficult.
And how did you feel Prabhupada's presence there?
Well, we knew that he was very concerned about Bombay, and that he really wanted to do something big there. So that was in our mind. And he would write very frequently. It seemed almost every 3 or 4 days we would get some letter, even though he was traveling in far places with instructions, with ideas. And we felt, at least, that Bombay was, you know, very much in the forefront of Srila Prabhupada's consciousness. And even though we weren't very qualified or experienced, but Srila Prabhupada was so concerned and so powerful that somehow or other he would make it work.
I know from sometimes being with Prabhupada in those years and a little later too, that when mail would come, each day there would be mail, maybe 6-7 letters. You'd say, is there anything from Bombay? And then that would be open first. So I think that would go on for years like that. And Prabhupada's expression, if he didn't hear from somebody that he wanted to hear from, why is he silent? And it seems to be such a heavy statement implying all kinds of reasons why that person was silent. Why is Giriraj silent? Even though you may have written a week ago. I wanted to talk about Yukta Vairagya as a theme here. One reason is there's such tremendous utilization of materials to build the temple and the politics involved. And also the sacrifice required by the devotees who are working on this project as a form of renunciation by doing the order of the spiritual master. Sometimes transcendentalists are afraid to deal with the material world because they think they'll get contaminated. But Prabhupada worked very hard to convert the material into spiritual. He converted the materialistic persons, and as no one had done before in the West, and also he converted materials, cement and building materials, into spiritual buildings and communities. We have this legacy, and it's sometimes difficult to know how much we should push ourselves to utilize the material world and when in fact we are going too far. So I wanted to ask Giriraj Maharaj's experience and realization about this, and particularly that, how did Prabhupada train you so that you were able to take this Yukta Vairagya even beyond what you perhaps thought you could do or wanted to do, doing such worldly things and pushing so hard.
How do you train you to do that?
I think the most powerful training that Srila Prabhupada gave about Yukta Vairagya was his own personal example. In Yukta Vairagya there should be no personal attachment. So personally Srila Prabhupada was completely detached. We could see that whether he was in a simple hut or in an opulent mansion, that he was the same, he wasn't affected. But he had very big plans to preach, and he would, you know, meet with lawyers, meet with contractors. He would do everything that was required to be done. And I think seeing his example was the main way that we learned.
Did you ever get frustrated or falter and go to him and say, I don't think I can do this, and he taught you something that made you able to keep going?
Well, I always was like in the mood of false renunciation, and I didn't like dealing with material things. I didn't like managing. So one time Srila Prabhupada spoke to me and he gave the example of Raghunath Das Goswami. In my mind I always liked the image of the Goswamis, even though I didn't really understand them. And he said that that Raghunath Das, he served his father just like an expert business manager. He took care of his father's estate. And then he went to Vrindavan and became a Goswami. And Srila Prabhupada indicated that I should do the same, that I should take care of my father's estate and, you know, act like an expert business manager and think of other things later.
There's an example you gave too that he taught you about the tricking the student into doing mathematics. The student doesn't want to learn mathematics as soon as he hears that that's the subject. No, I won't do it. So then the teacher says, all right, no mathematics, don't worry. And then on the board he draws a picture of a cow or something and says, how many front legs does he have? And he counts, two. How many back legs? Two. How many legs together? Four. And this way he's doing arithmetic. But he had refused. So how did he apply that story?
Well, I was mild by nature, so I didn't know how to get people to do things that they were supposed to do. But then I saw some other managers who were like very forceful, and to me it seemed like they were using force, but I wasn't sure if that was right either. So I asked Srila Prabhupada, and Srila Prabhupada, you know, he was quite concerned, and he said, no, we can't force them, but we can trick them. And then he told the story that you mentioned, that we can induce people who are reluctant, how we can induce them.
The story of Bombay is so many fights. And when we just talk about this in spiritual life, when we try to preach and there's opposition, we speak of attacks by Maya. We brought this up in discussing Prabhupada's stroke in 1967. This is for you, by the way, this week. So I have a few quotes about this that we can think of in terms of the opposition in Bombay There are different characters, and Mr. Nair and other characters, Mrs. Nair and the lawyers and so on. But is Maya behind this, or what kind of Leela is this? Here's Prabhupada explaining the principle. In regard to his attack, he says that he was very successful in preaching. My declaration of war against Maya is certainly a great battle. Maya saw me very successful within 1 year, so that I got many sincere young followers like yourself. It was a great defeat to the activities of Maya. So she fought back. Gave him a death dash. Then he says in a Path of Perfection, chapter 8, to pursue the transcendental path is more or less to declare war on the illusory energy. When we accept any process of self-realization, we are declaring war against Maya. Therefore, Maya is certain to place many difficulties before us. There is a chance of failure, and one has to become very steady. Material nature becomes more stringent and vigorous in our efforts to test how much the aspiring spiritualist is sincere. So this is the Siddhanta of opposition, and I think we can apply it in Bombay also. Prabhupada once expressed it that Maya, after all, is a devotee of Krishna, not that she's like in the Christian idea there's a Satan who's actually got some power, he's against God. But everyone is working for Krishna, but her job is to punish the rascals. So she keeps testing us to see if we're a rascal. And then when we prove by so many endeavors that we're not, then she's pleased. And she says, ah, you have triumphed, and is glad to see that this is a real devotee. Would you like to make any... I haven't specifically applied that to Bombay, but do you think? Can you think of anything that would substantiate that explanation that you're being tested by Maya? So Prabhupada set out on a world tour right at the time when he left the devotees, and they had made a down payment and were supposed to get a deed for that down payment. That was the agreement. But Mr. Nair, the owner, did not deliver the deed. And this plus other complications began to cause Prabhupada anxiety as he traveled elsewhere. We can't know what the spiritual master Prabhupada is thinking at all times as he would go to different places, but we could put it together by circumstantial evidence, by the letters that he wrote and by statements that he would make that I am thinking of Bombay even while he was in another place. I was in some places that he visited, and he was in New Brindavan when the fight was going on in Bombay. He was in Dallas, and he did all his activities normally and preached normally, and he didn't reveal this to the devotees except maybe to a secretary who was traveling with him. So in one sense, we didn't know what he was thinking of. So the fact is that Prabhupada, he did both. He lived in the present moment with devotees wherever he was. He was capable of being absorbed in that peacefully, but at the same time, while he was instructing devotees in each place, he always turned his thoughts to Bombay. And beyond these two concerns, he was also absorbed in his eternal relationship with Radha and Krishna in Braj. So I'll try to ask you, Giriraj Maharaj, about this description. Do you think, were you aware that Prabhupada was always thinking of Bombay, or do you think this portrait of him traveling around the world and thinking of Bombay is an exaggeration? And then how often did you keep in touch with him?
We felt that he was thinking about Bombay. He wrote so often, and when he wrote, he would express his concerns about the progress. And sometimes he would even write in the letter that I'm always thinking of Bombay. And we were also always thinking of him. So Maybe the spiritual master can reciprocate with all of the disciples so that each one thinks that Prabhupada is always thinking of his project. But anyway, definitely we felt that he was. Not that it was exclusive, but we definitely felt that he was. And I think from the number of letters he wrote and the concern he expressed, he actually was thinking of it.
It was like a kind of obsession of transcendental anxiety. Now, what was actually happening? What were these intrigues that were going on? We've described in some detail in unabridged volume. You have read the abridged volume, which doesn't have all the details. And Giriraj Maharaj is in the progress of writing a book about this whole story, as Prabhupada says, it is worth writing about. Then for our purposes today, I have listed some of the things that were worrying Prabhupada and what was going on that Giriraj was dealing with in Bombay. This is the part that I thought it would be difficult to make it so interesting, but maybe I can read them off, some of the steps I have here, and just ask you to comment on them, on the whole picture. So Mr. Nair would not give the deed, even though ISKCON had made their down payment. It appeared that he wanted to keep the down payment and keep the land. And he had actually done that with a previous prospective buyer of the land. He was now selling it for the second time. It looked like he was doing the same thing, a real cheater. So on what basis was he not signing the deed? He claimed that the devotees had failed to get a clearance from the Charity Commission, and therefore the land was his. They were improperly on a land they should vacate. As things got complicated, and Giriraj Maharaj was responding, but this problem wasn't becoming untangled, he sent some more leading managers there. He sent Tamal Krishna Maharaj and Karander, who was like his top manager in America, and Shyam Sundar, and they were all to go to Bombay to help Giriraj. Another thing that happened that Prabhupada took very seriously as alarming was he got a letter from his lawyer. Now they had hired a lawyer to deal with the complications. The lawyer sent a letter and said, "I'm no longer your lawyer, I resign." So Prabhupada took this, that this lawyer is actually one of the cheaters. Now there's some kind of complicity between him and Nair. He was very alarmed about this. So Prabhupada summarized the position in a letter he wrote with 8 different points, and the conclusion is we have to go to court to have a legal fight. What Prabhupada wanted was that Mr. Nair should give the deed and accept full payment, which the devotees were willing to make. This was the difficult situation that was developing. You want to make a comment on it? Good.
Mr. Nair was a big cheater, as you indicated. He was very clever and also very influential in Bombay. He was the owner of one of the big daily newspapers. He had been the sheriff of Bombay. And in our case, he did 2 things that were very cunning. First of all, he made friends or already had some relationship with our lawyer, and for the sales agreement and for the possession of the land, Srila Prabhupada had paid 1 lakh rupees, 100,000 rupees, and he had left another 100,000 rupees with the lawyer to be paid when the conveyance was executed. But the lawyer gave Nair the other 1 lakh rupees without getting the conveyance. So that was the first thing. And the second thing is that Mr. Nair deliberately put in the sales agreement that we had to get the permission of the charity commissioner, knowing well, or at least thinking, that he could pay the charity commissioner. In India, many things are done by paying or bribing the government officers. So he was confident that he could make sure that we wouldn't get the permission from the charity commissioner. And therefore he would have grounds to cancel the whole agreement and claim that we forfeited the money and, as you said, keep the land and the money.
As an example that Prabhupada was still functioning in his normal preaching, while things were building up to a real tense situation, Prabhupada didn't just rush to Bombay. When he went to India, he went to Vrindavan for the Kartik month and gave those wonderful lectures we have on tape, and a large group of devotees were with him. So, however, while he was there, he did deal with Bombay, and there's one exchange which we have in, documented in letters, where now Mr. Nair was threatening the devotees. He had hired a gunda hoodlum who would stand near the entrance of the land brandishing a machete, and they turned off the water and electricity. So it was getting near violence with threats. And the devotees had written Prabhupada a letter that they thought they should give up the land. And so Prabhupada wrote a letter back. He was like, in his thinking, he was like a lawyer, very logically countering the points of objection that the devotees made to keeping the land. And so one point he made was that the refusal by the charity commission, which Nair had spoken of, was not some final thing, it was just a delay. So that was not a grounds for our having to leave the land, just because we didn't have the permission yet. That Mr. Nair had claimed that there was a 6-month limit before you had to get the charity approval. But he said that, but there was no such law. And there are other points that he made. But the main point, I think, was that he said, don't be afraid, don't be bullied. You seem to be afraid by this person's threat. Our position is strong. And this is Prabhupada typically being courageous, as we've seen at other times in his life. He was not to be pushed around or taken advantage of. I want to move, because I want to ask Giriraj Maharaj about what happened later, in that same mood of the devotees thinking that it's too difficult. Although Prabhupada wrote them, our position is strong, don't give up. It eventually happened that they did give up. Prabhupada arranged to meet with Mr. Nair while Prabhupada was in Hyderabad, and they worked out a new agreement, with some compromise in it. Prabhupada would pay some extra money for a government tax that Mr. Nair had to pay. And so a new agreement was made. But after Prabhupada did that, and was traveling again elsewhere in India, the devotees got together and they decided that they should cancel the agreement that had been made if they could get their down payment back and leave the land. And there was discussion that it was just, even if they could get the land, Shyama Sundar was saying, it was such a hard place to develop. So this, in every way, this seems inauspicious. So they canceled the agreement with their lawyer without asking Prabhupada about it while he was in Ahmedabad. And just briefly, we described Giriraj Maharaj telling Prabhupada this. He phoned Prabhupada, and Prabhupada picked up the phone. Bhakti Vedanta Swami here. Giriraj was saying that a devotee had come from Ahmedabad with a message. Yes, yes, Prabhupada said, what is the point? Finally, Giriraj blurted out that they had cancelled the sales agreement. Prabhupada was silent. Then in a voice that expressed both anger and resignation, he said, then everything is finished. So, how could the devotees have done this without Prabhupada's wanting it and without his approval?
There was some offensive mentality involved. Actually, Shamsundar thought, I mean, in one sense it's almost not nice to say, but maybe for the sake of learning something, we can mention it. He thought that Srila Prabhupada had made a mistake in trying for the Juhu land, because he thought that the Juhu property was too far from Bombay, no one would come, and so on. And then he further thought that Srila Prabhupada would not admit the fact that he made a mistake. So even though he made a mistake, he didn't want to admit it, and therefore he was pursuing the matter. Then Shamsundar said, and this is another type of offensive mentality, that even if we get the land, we're going to be stuck. Means he was like trying to convince the others that you're going to be stuck, you know, with the land and having to build the project for years. So the best thing is just to cancel the agreement and get out of the whole thing.
In a previous class, we were discussing how sometimes to follow the order of the spiritual master, you have to do so even though other God brothers may disagree. And we saw Prabhupada in that position. And I told a story how once I failed to do that. I had an order from Prabhupada. So what was your involvement if Shamsundar didn't agree? Did you agree to cancel?
I feel like one of these
district attorney. Actually, I didn't agree. Two of us were like relatively junior. That was Pancha Devita and myself. And we weren't really able to change the way things were going, but we didn't agree with the decision. And we made some effort to convince them, but actually they were, you know, they were the big leaders. And they had the authority, or they were exercising the authority.
They were all GBC. You were on GBC.
No, we were not. And the line of argument also, speaking about Srila Prabhupada as if he were an ordinary, mundane person, was not nice for us to hear.
We're running out of time. So Prabhupada said, I shall be the last man to give up the Hare Krishna land to the rogue, Mr. Nair. But things got more and more heated. And without telling all the steps, what finally happened was that Mr. Nair died after trying to get into an argument with Prabhupada. Shortly after that, he passed away. And then Mrs. Nair pursued the fight with her lawyers, and one day she managed to convince the police, or her lawyers did, the police to come out and demolish the makeshift temple that the devotees had there. Would you like to tell us any impressions about that demolition and connection with serving Prabhupada?